honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. When we left off with 98-year-old World War II fighter pilot Bill Jukes, he had brought his crippled P-51 Mustang down, hoping some trees would help slow him down. The most remarkable aspects of that whole experience we haven't heard yet, so let's continue now with Bill Jukes.
I didn't realize I hit my elbow on a little switch, and it broke off in my elbow, and that was the only actual blood damage that I had. And my airplane just started disintegrating around me. And I'm buckled in a seat, fortunately. The engine broke off, and it was on fire, of course. The cockpit broke away, and it ended up in the bomb dump down in the hole in the ground. So when things settle down, I'm sitting there and I can't feel anything, and I'm just roaring in my ears and what have you. My seatbelt is still secured. I unhooked that and unhooked my parachute and climbed up out of this hole in the ground. And they were shooting foam on this burning engine up at the top. When I got out of this hole, I'm in this cloud of whatever anti-fire stuff. I couldn't think, and all this funny noises going on in my head and everything. I said, my God, I'm dead, I'm getting out of here. And I turn around and I take off, and they're chasing me with the ambulance. And they finally, a friend of mine jumped out of the ambulance and grabbed me and threw me down on the ground, and they picked me up. And I don't remember anything there until I woke up. I was in the attic of a farmhouse, and there were stretchers, people injured, just moaning, groaning, and noise. That's when I started hurting. Man, finally, you think of moving, particularly this arm, So I called for the medic, and they came and gave me a shot of morphine, I guess it was, something like that, and I floated off to sleep. So the next morning, boy, I hurt. Oh, I hurt all over. And they got me out of there into a tent hospital, and they fixed it. This arm, put a cast on it, and got me on a DC-3 ambulance airplane, and I'm in the stretcher, I got my shoes tied around my neck, and I didn't have any clothes. All my belongings are back in my tent, and I ended up in England in a hospital. I was in various hospitals in England until they finally said I was cured, and they gave me 30 days recovery. They said, you're going back, sending you home to Canada. And I didn't want to go home to Canada. For the thing from my mind, I want to stay. I met this girl who became our wife. So I talked them out of sending me home. They said, okay, you get another 30 days, and then you're going to have a medical examination, and if you don't pass it, you're out of here, and if you do, you can stay. So, man, I quit drinking, and got well, and long story short, I took that medical and I passed it. Meanwhile, I was in touch with my squadron, and they agreed to have me back. They shouldn't have. They should have kicked me out. But anyway, they asked Air Ministry to post me back to that squadron. They didn't. That's when I got back, and it was all right from that then on.
So you went back to flying?
Yeah. Meanwhile, I was a pilot officer when I first got to England. By the time I ended up, I was a flight lieutenant, which was equivalent to captain. I got back in 65 Squadron. Meanwhile, they were in Scotland escorting bullfighters and Mosquito twin-engine Navy airplanes on shipping strikes in Norway. And we were their escort to Norway. And Germany had a red-hot couple of squadrons there at Bergen. They were really red hot, those guys. Bow fighters, mosquitoes, you know, they thought they were good, but they couldn't outmaneuver a German, no way. I can remember the Germans were cagey. What they would do, they would take off from Bergen, head west, and get partway out. They'd turn around and they'd come back, and they were behind the attacking airplanes, and they weren't expecting anybody, you know, because they would expect to see them coming this way. So we corrected that because we had a section of four airplanes at the flight that would stay with these attacking bullfighters and mosquitoes, and we'd stay behind them and prevent any sneaking in from the Germans. And I remember this one graphic thing that I can remember. There was a little harbor and had a hill or a mountain on each side, and it was a narrow space, just ships could get in and out, and it had this harbor, and it was landlocked all around. And they had this German tanker. That's what they were doing, was bringing fuel in. They could only get through this little entrance, these airplanes, these happened to be bullfighters this day. And they had a rocket under each wing. And when they set off the rocket, you could see a black smoke. You could always tell when they fired. This leader lined up, went through this thing, and meanwhile, the ship opened fire on him and destroyed him. But he let his rockets go, and they hit that tanker and exploded in that harbor. It was the most graphic thing I've ever seen. And there was flame on the water, you know, all over the place. And meanwhile, everybody folded up and lined up and went home, and that was the end of that. But that was the most graphic thing, seeing that ship blow up. And there were different things that happened there, but that North Sea was a real, they gave you 8 minutes if you ditched and went down in that North Sea at that time of year. You could last 8 minutes and then you'd die of hypothermia or whatever they called it. But our engines never missed a lick, and we just went merrily there and back, and time after time. And that's where I ended the war, was there. That's when the war ended.
I want to ask you a little more about your crash, because as you're describing it and I'm picturing it, I mean, it seems like an absolute nightmare all the way through. But, you know, as someone who had never heard that story before, unlike you, who've probably told it 100 times, I was thinking, how in the world did he live through that? Have you ever asked yourself that question?
Well, yeah, it was strictly a miracle. Yeah, I should have died, yeah. I imagine that first row of trees slowed the airplane down a second, and then instead of growing under power, like it was a drop, instead of, you know, wasn't like going flaming into the ground, that would kill you. All of this, the two trees you lined up and got through and that sort of stuff, it all built up to this. They were saving me for something. Yeah.
But you're so disoriented from the experience that you go running away, you're out of your mind.
Well, you know, I figured that was the end. That was, you know, they were going to send me home, and then that would be the end of my flying career and everything, you know. And it meant a lot to me. So I did everything I could. The little deal I worked out, another 30 days, a medical examination. I had met at one time a senior medical officer, a Canadian. I contacted him, explained my situation, told him I didn't want to, you know, I knew that if I didn't start flying again soon, I never would, and could he help me? And he said, well, just show up in 30 days, I'll arrange for this medical, and if you pass it, you pass it. If you don't, you don't. I pulled a string, if you know what I mean. It worked, so I got to stay. And from then on, until I ended up at Columbus Estates, I flew for a living the rest of my life.
And the kind of flying you were doing is something that touches a lot of lives, and they probably don't even realize it. But being in the crop dusting business, or aerial application business, as they call it now, you helped protect the crops that the rest of us have been eating our whole lives.
Yeah.
Do you know how many hours in the cockpit you have in your life? Have you calculated that?
Yeah, not very many. I think about 17,000, 18,000 hours, something like that.
Is that all?
Yeah. When I left the military, I got my logbook. It was about 1,200 hours or something like that. That was my flying time. The majority of my time I made was in the crop dusting. I was 35 years in the crop dusting business.
Arvin Ayer, I'm sure some of your old clients are listening to you right now and having some good memories come back. I know there's so much more that we could talk about, but there's not too many guys around, especially today, who flew both the Spitfire and the Mustang.
Yeah.
Do you have a favorite between the two? Can you help us understand the difference?
Well, I have a little bill that I wrote up, and it's got a picture of me sitting on the cockpit of a P-51 Mustang. It shows a silhouette of the Mustang, and my caption on it is, "My beautiful Mustang that always brought me home." So, I have to say that sentimentally, the Mustang meant more to me, but for selfishly getting in the best fighter in the world at the time, that Mark 14 Spitfire, boy, that was like my whole career was based on that. That was the most fantastic airplane. It could outclimb, it could outdive, it could outrun, it could out everything. Thing that I ever flew, just amazing. That airplane there probably had 1,200 horsepower engine in it, and the 14 had a 1,300 Rolls Royce Griffin. Instead of a V8, it was an H model.
I don't want to put thoughts in your head or words in your mouth, but I'm just curious as you describe that crash, and we're talking 77 years ago now. I can tell it's very vivid. I'm just wondering if going through that, is there any element of all these years since? I mean, you're 21 then, you're 98 now. Is there an element of living on borrowed time or making things count because your life was, as you said, miraculously spared?
Well, yeah, yes and no. Selfishly, I say the reason I'm 98 years old and alive is because I was good enough to have made it, not to mention the lucky breaks and what have you along the line, you know. But in my weaker moments when I stop and think, I think, you SOB, you're dead lucky, you're alive. Yeah. But now, crop dusting, that's a very exciting, I mean, you know, like that's dirty work, really. In the early days, it was all dust, and it would get all over you, and you'd get in your ears, and we'd get on you. It was terrible. Finally, they had to outlaw it because the dust drifted all over the place, you know, you couldn't control it. That's why they went to spray. That was the evolution, you might say, of crop dusting. But basically, a crop duster, and you ask your friend Doug Thiel, the secret to staying alive as a crop duster is to think ahead. Always know when you're going this way down that field, you know where you're going to turn around and come back, and you know what's there. You look and see. You know there's a standpipe there, and you know it's going to be there, and you have to go around it and that sort of thing. So that's the key to staying alive, is to look ahead. Plan ahead.
I think that could apply to a lot of people's lives listening out there.
Yeah, and stay sober. I don't mean you can't go out and get drunk the night before, but don't be sitting in the cockpit half loaded. You're just asking for it. Don't ever do that.
Yeah, I'm sure there's plenty we left out, but I do need to ask you. I mean, because you're 98 years old, going to be 99 in April. When you look back over all those years, and you've talked about a few high points in your life, is there something that you would say you're most proud of or most thankful for?
Oh, yeah. I'm most proud that actually I was the CO's number two, always, in 65 Squadron, and I'm proud of that. And when I left, I can show you my logbook, he signed assessment above average, And he knew, because we flew together, I was an accomplished formation pilot. to be good at formation flying, the person you're formating on had to be good, so that he didn't make any unnecessary moves and that sort of thing, and you depended on him. So all I had to do was get in there tight, as close as I could without hitting him, and just follow where he would lead. And we went through many, many times like that. And he knew that I wasn't going to hit him. I knew that he wasn't going to do anything. Like, you know, you did signals, you were going to turn this way, you'd go like this, and if you're going to turn that way, you'd go that way. And that's all you do. You wouldn't say anything and do anything. So you knew ahead all the time what was going to happen and what was going on. I think probably the thing I'm most proud of is that assessment in my logbook. It meant a tremendous, a big deal to me. Yeah. Yeah. Just handwritten assessment above average, signed John Foster, S.L. Squadron leader, yeah.
Those words of affirmation carry so much power, applicable in so many ways. We're just about out of time, but I've got to thank my friend Arnold Martinez, a loyal Hometown Heroes listener in Kern County who has captured so much World War II history himself traveling around to interview veterans. He's the one who introduced me to Mr. Jukes, and Arnold reminds me there's a story about a unique encounter with a Luftwaffe pilot over a Norwegian fjord.
We rolled. Screwed up, you know. Beforehand, we knew the fjord we were going to be operating in, and we knew you could go out that fjord and there was room to turn around and come back. You couldn't climb over, but you could turn around. You knew that. So we were all airplanes going all over the place. And I'm going up this fjord, and there's a 109 coming down. And as we passed, I couldn't believe it. This guy waved at me. You know, and by the time I waved back, he was, you know, gone. He didn't see it. I was hoping that he knew that I recognized it. And I don't know what happened to him, whether he survived the war or not. All I know is that I did, and almost didn't, but did.
So you didn't want him to think you were rude and didn't wave back?
Yeah, but, you know, there was a case there, and I wrote it up in one of my pieces that I wrote about this pilot who came to our squadron. He was kind of a misfit. He was a warrant officer, but there weren't too many warrant officer pilots. So he'd been around a while, and we didn't go out of our way to try to make him welcome or anything. You know, us old-timers thought we knew all about it, you know, and all that stuff. Talk about going up and down the fjord. I was headed up there, and he was headed down, and there was a 109 on his tail, and it was absolutely plastering him. He was on fire. He did something, I don't know how he did it, but he made an impossible maneuver and turned around and got on the tail of that 109 and shot him down. Then he went over and went straight in. Yeah. And, you know, as old-timer, felt so guilty after seeing that great exhibition of flying. Just felt guilty, you know, for not befriending that guy, you know. He sure showed us what was for.
He made a loop with the airplane that you didn't think was possible?
Exactly, yeah, and he's on fire, and, you know, and obviously I would say he personally wasn't hit by anything, but just to be able to do that, you know, he probably could never do it to just show up and try to do it. Yeah, he just did it, yeah.
In that moment, and that takes a lot of courage, too.
Yeah, my grandfather was Irish, and he had that Irish emotional thing. And I inherited for me to sort of break down talking to you is you know, it really hurts my feelings, but I couldn't help it. I'm sorry. Hey.
I think we can all agree no apology is necessary here. Instead, we're all grateful because that emotion makes it all so much more real for the rest of us. Bill Jukes, 98 years old. What a unique story we got to hear today, but we're out of time. Thank you so much for listening to Hometown Heroes. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.